From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Sunday marks the 15-year anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon that took the lives of nearly 3,000 people and injured more than 6,000 others. A look at how that tragic day has shaped our nation and continues to impact the lives of survivors. We'll also explore contents of the recently declassified 28 pages of the congressional inquiry into the attack. Plus, earlier this summer, sea turtle monitoring efforts pointed to a robust and possibly record-breaking nesting season, but recent high tides, stormy weather, and Hurricane Hermine have taken a toll on sea turtle nests. We'll get the latest nesting data. First, this news. This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Sea turtle nesting season here in Florida runs through the end of October. And earlier this summer, experts tracking nesting activity say signs pointed to a possibly record-breaking year. But recent high tides and stormy weather have flooded and washed out nests on local beaches. We'll get the latest nesting data from Southwest Florida. We'll also hear from the Big Bend area for a look at how Hurricane Hermine has impacted sea turtle nesting after the storm made landfall there last week. But first, Sunday marks the 15-year anniversary of the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001 on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon that took the lives of nearly 3,000 people, injured more than 6,000 others, and caused more than $10 billion in damages. Like the assassination of JFK, the 9/11 attacks remains forever etched in our minds. Nearly all of us remember where we were and what we were doing as news of the attacks began to unfold. Today we take a look back at how that tragedy has shaped our nation and continues to impact the lives of survivors. We'll also be exploring the contents of the recently declassified 28 pages of the congressional inquiry into the attacks, based largely on information gathered by the FBI and the CIA in the year following the attack, and what they reveal about possible connections between the 9/11 hijackers and Saudi Arabian officials. Joining me now is former Florida Governor and U.S. Senator Bob Graham. Graham was chairman of the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee and was co-chair of the congressional inquiry into the attacks. He has long called for the declassification of those 28 pages of that congressional inquiry before they were released in July. He's also the creator of the Bob Graham Center for Public Service at the University of Florida. And during his campaign working the jobs of ordinary Floridians, Graham actually hosted an edition of this very program. Thanks for joining us today and welcome back, Senator Graham.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Joining us in studio is Mohammed Al-Darsani. He's the imam and founder of the Islamic Center for Peace in Fort Myers. In addition to conducting worship services, Al-Darsani directs the center's Islamic studies, community outreach initiatives, interfaith dialogues, and faith-based counseling services. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us in studio is former WGCU reporter and host of All Things Considered, Valerie Alker. She was with President George W. Bush at the Emma Booker Elementary School in Sarasota the morning of the attacks. Welcome back, Val.
Thank you, John. It's nice to be back, and thank you for inviting me.
And we're joined by Garrett Lindgren, a retired New York City firefighter now living in Manatee County. He was among the firefighters responding to Ground Zero that day. He worked with Rescue Company 3, one of only five rescue companies in all the boroughs of New York City, and was trained in building collapse, hazmat, and other high-risk operations. Thanks for your time today as well, Garrett.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I also invite listeners to join the conversation and connect with our guests. Phone lines are open for your comments and questions at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org or tweet using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. And Valerie, let's begin with you. Prior to news of the terrorist attacks, what do you remember about that morning? Were you actually in a classroom with President Bush?
No, I was not in a classroom with him. I was with I think there was one media person in there. It was a pool. I was with the larger group of reporters in the media room of the library, waiting for the president to come out and address the students. He was there with his Secretary of Education, Rod Page, and also with Frank Brogan, who was Florida's lieutenant governor at that time. And Brogan had begun his professional career as an educator in Martin County. It's Florida. So I was there with the crowd, and it was, you know, I had covered presidential visits before, so I was not new to it. And, you know, it was a hurry up and wait, be early. But on that particular morning, I called the newsroom here at WGCU at about 14 minutes before 9. And I spoke to Amy Tardif, and I told her that I thought that, you know, all the ducks were in the row. The president was, you know, right on time. And I asked her if there's anything going on here. And she said, well, a passenger plane just flew into the World Trade Center. And I said, oh, my, and hung up. And I said, well, I'll let you know what goes on later. And I hung up with Amy, and I told a few of the reporters around me. I was with the CNN crew because I was radio and didn't have a lot of equipment. And they said, no, it couldn't have been a passenger plane because that's restricted area. It could not have happened. And then I called back about 10 or 12 minutes later, and I was on the phone with an employee we had there at the time, Taylor Lewis, talking to him, and he was watching TV just as the second plane hit. And he went, oh, my God. And the change in the media room, as soon as the second plane hit, about, I would say, you know, I was telling people, a second plane hit. And people's cell phones and beepers started going off like crazy, and it was a cacophony of sound, and the suspense, the feeling was just palpable. It was like, oh my gosh, what does this mean? And then, of course, everyone was waiting on the president. Will he come out and speak, or will he, you know, depart immediately for Air Force One and go wherever he needs to go? And so the TV camera crews were packing their equipment. They had one foot here and one foot out the door, ready to respond in any way they needed to. I was, you know, I had very little equipment. I just had a, you know, recording device and a mic cord plugged into a Molt box. So I was cool. And we waited there for, I don't know, 15 minutes for the president to come out, and at which point he did, and he made his, you know, now, you know, memorable words. It's apparent that there has been a terrorist attack on our country, and I want to say one thing before I depart, because there are many more who have much more to add to this conversation than I do, but I saw Michael Moore's film Fahrenheit 9/11 and the way he sort of lampooned the president, and I feel that President Bush stayed in the room with the children to collect his thoughts, to think what he was going to say in front of a nation at such a momentous hour. And he came out, and he was very gracious to the crowd, to the children that were gathered at the school waiting for him to speak, to celebrate their success in reading. And he was very presidential, very dignified, very controlled, very measured, and he was just what you would have wanted to see on that day at that time in a commander-in-chief. And then he made his speech, he left, and we all left.
Right.
And that is my story, except I had this really hot, you know, hot sound. I didn't know what to do with it because it was, you know, before we had some of the recording methods we have now where we can easily transfer sound files. Mm-hmm. I had a mini disc. But anyway, and I will say, I don't know if you know this, but Amy Tardif's cousin worked for one of the firms in the towers. I can't remember the name of it, a big one, and he was lost. Her young cousin was lost in that day. So we, you know, what was the name of the, I can't remember, but yes, he was lost. So it was quite a day and one that I will always remember. But I, you know, saying that, I know that many more people suffered much greater losses and had much more happen to them on that day than I did. I just happened to have been an eyewitness to one part of what was an momentous occasion in our nation's history.
All right. And Garrett Lindgren, you're a Brooklyn native. Your father was a New York City Fire Department deputy chief. You worked as an EMT before becoming a firefighter yourself. Is kind of being a first responder something that was just in your blood?
Yeah, I actually grew up really wanting to be a firefighter. Just, I suppose, because I was so impressed with what my dad did and what he stood for. He was a World War II vet. Who fought in the European theater, subsequently was a 36-year veteran, the FDNY, just knowing him And the people who worked alongside him from a very early age, they just left such an impression on me. They were just towers of people. They were amazing. It seemed they could do anything, and they just were the most caring people you could imagine.
And on the morning of September 11th, 2001, you were filling in for a shift on in Queens, east of Manhattan, east of Brooklyn, and you were on a bridge headed back to your home station in the Bronx when you heard news about a fire in the Twin Towers. What did that mean to you as a firefighter? What did you think had happened initially?
I thought it was probably a minor news story. There's a fire station directly across the street from the Trade Center. They call it 10 House. It's Engine 10 and Ladder 10. And they routinely responded to the World Trade Center multiple times every day. As you can imagine, the World Trade Center, were each tower was like its own city. There were so many people who worked and visited in there each day. So there were always many incidents, medical emergencies, which the fire department responds to, alarms, minor fires, overheated elevator motors, and it runs the gamut. So I didn't really think much of it. I was only out of the firehouse in Queens, Rescue 4 in Queens, for several minutes. And when I had left the firehouse, there had been really no major activity in the city. Subsequently, I hear this breaking report on a local news station that there was some type of fire at the World Trade Center, and I casually glanced to my left, and the towers are easily visible from the Triborough Bridge, which is where I was. And I saw what America was seeing live on national TV was this gaping hole in the side of the North Tower that it looked like eight floors or so, and a tremendous volume of fire on all those floors, and a smoke cloud that was already almost across the Hudson River to New Jersey. My initial thought when I saw that was that someone had detonated a bomb up there because of the major, major structural damage I was seeing coupled with that massive amount of fire. The World Trade Center was what we knew as a fireproof high-rise building. I don't think anything's totally fireproof, but it certainly slows the progression of a fire significantly. So to see that much fire in a fireproof high-rise building that quickly, it has to have had some tremendous amount of assistance to propagate that quickly. So again, my initial thought was that someone had detonated a bomb and that it was a terrorist attack. Terrorism was already in the forefront of our training in the FDNY and had been for years after the 93 bombing of the World Trade Center. And we were constantly training to respond to various types of terrorist attacks. So it really wasn't a stretch in my mind that that's what had occurred. By the time I completed my journey over the bridge and got into the Bronx, the second tower was hit by another passenger jet, as we all know now. And that just, you know, of course, confirmed what I was already thinking. I had already called my wife at her job and told her, get the kids out of school. We're under attack. And I don't know how this is going to end today. I don't know what the next event is going to be, but it's not going to be good. And a lot of people are going to die. So you need to do that right now. And she was on the other end of the phone saying, what in the world are you talking about? I can only imagine now what that sounded like to her at the time, but I knew what was going on. And, that was the beginning of, really one of the worst days of my life.
Right. And that 14-mile trek from the Bronx to lower Manhattan, that you made that day, you know, that can take close to an hour, even on a good day.
But sure.
Tell us about, you know, kind of what was going through your mind, knowing that you're now almost certainly heading in the direction of what is going to be an historic attack.
Well, I officially was off to that point. I continued on to my firehouse in the Bronx, knowing that rescue company, three, would already have responded, but also knowing that the magnitude of this incident was going to require all of the resources of our department, including everyone who was not on duty. So my initial goal was to get to the firehouse quickly, grab the company roster and get on the phone and start calling everybody that was off duty to make sure they were aware of what was going on. I knew if they were aware, they were already coming in. Nobody would, in a situation like that, no one on my job would wait for orders to come into the firehouse. They would just know they're going to be needed. I walked in the door and took one step toward the staircase to go up to the office. And over there are a voice alarm system in the firehouse, which connects our dispatcher to every firehouse in the city. They made the announcement by orders of Chief of Department Gansey. All members, all off-duty members, are ordered to immediately report to their firehouses. That was one of Chief Gansey's last orders he ever gave. He was killed in the collapse of the first tower. It fell on the command post. And a great man and an amazing leader, and his life was snuffed out fairly early on in the event. Before I could get upstairs to dial the phone, my captain and two other firefighters from my company who had been detailed out to dive rescue recertification, they came into the firehouse. We made a quick plan to put all our gear in our captain's private car and head for our special operations center on Roosevelt Island, where we were supposed to get a spare rescue truck and put it in service for the purpose of responding to what we thought at the time may be additional terrorist attacks, as all five of the heavy rescue companies in the city were already operating at the Trade Center. Before that plan could be put into place, the South Tower collapsed. And then our goal was, let's grab as much equipment as we can. We put it into a fire department van, 12-passenger van, and a reserve pumper. And we had about 12 of us that were off duty. And we responded from Roosevelt Island at that point. And as you illustrated earlier, you know, it can take an hour to travel a very short distance easily when there's heavy traffic. As soon as we came out of Queens Midtown Tunnel, we encountered gridlock. I believe, if I remember correctly, we actually drove on the sidewalk at one point and were then able to get onto the East River Drive and head downtown. As we were going down and getting close to the scene, we encountered hundreds or thousands of civilians fleeing the Trade Center. Actually, were on the roadway running. The northbound lanes was just a sea of people, and half of the southbound lanes were just people running for their lives, screaming, which was, wow, I had seen a lot in my time on the job, and it was difficult to take in. It was horrifying. Shortly before we arrived, the North Tower fell, and we arrived to zero visibility and total radio silence on our fire ground radios, which was extremely eerie because we already had many hundreds of firefighters on the scene, and each one of them has a portable radio, and there wasn't one transmission. We were in, as they say, zero visibility in the street, and my captain made several attempts to contact the on-duty crew from Rescue 3, and there was no answer. And somebody in our group just said, everybody's dead, which is just unthinkable. You know, we didn't generally lose hundreds and hundreds of firefighters at a time at incidents. Many firefighters on our job died over the years in the line of duty, but generally it would be in a range of 1 to 3 per incident, occasionally 6. One incident that I can think of back in the 1960s, 12 of our members were killed at one fire, and all tragic and unthinkable. But as it turned out that morning, 343 New York City firefighters were killed, along with 60 police officers. So you know, it's unfathomable.
Garrett, what was it like working ground zero in the days immediately following the attack, you know, knowing that you'd lost so many friends and colleagues? And what led to your own injury that led you to retire from the fire department in 2002?
Well, working the site was surreal. I have to believe that most, if not all of us who worked there, were in some level of shock. It was more than the human mind is designed to take in. Initially it was like a nuclear winter. The first day, everything was just covered in this thick, toxic ash that was deep like a snowstorm. Everything was covered in it. There was really no color there. It was just gray and white, I would say. As the days went on, it was just a very sad, very dangerous operation. Many of us didn't even realize how dangerous it was at the time. And after several days of working there, my lieutenant, who had, I don't know, probably 35 years on the department, he was very experienced, had worked in very busy parts of the city. And we took a break one day, and he said to us, you know, guys, I don't think most of you realize this is some of the most dangerous work that we've ever done. And we did a lot of dangerous work on our job. That's the nature of being a firefighter. We weren't really, I don't think, comprehending it so much. We were doing all kinds of confined space entries and working at high angles and on very unstable ground. There was a tremendous fire burning deep in the bowels of the collapse, to the point where some days we worked a lot on top of the South Tower, and some days you could be standing in a position, and what we did basically was pick through the rubble oftentimes with almost like gardening tools, because it was just such a fine mess of particulate there to go through. And suddenly it would become untenable. You could not stay where you were standing because the heat from the fire below would suddenly find a new pathway and would just blast up. It was like you were standing on top of a chimney, and you'd have to move. And I did hear of some of our firefighters where actually the soles of their we used to wear a leather firefighting boot, very heavy and with a protective insole in that. And some of the guys, actually, their boots started melting where they were standing because it got so hot. And we were being subjected to smoke that I had never seen in all the fires I'd ever been to, different colors, orange and red and green. And obviously now we know that there were numerous serious toxins that were throughout the site, and we were just being bathed in it. But as I say, it was just difficult to take in. It was sometimes it almost seemed like I was hovering over the scene, which sounds odd, but it was just very, very difficult to understand. You know, we were finding little pieces of fire equipment. We would recognize it because we had to know our equipment the same way a military person knows their weapon.
Right.
So we were finding little bitty pieces of our self-contained breathing apparatus, and that would clue us in that, hey, maybe we're going to find the remains of one of our brother firefighters here. And often that would be the case as we would dig into the stairwells and that. But honestly, I never saw a telephone in the pile. I never saw an office desk or a door. Nothing, really, a computer. Nothing that should have been there in massive numbers. And, you know, as we were told, it was due to a couple of things. One was the unbelievable force of, you know, 110-story building pancaking down, which really crushed and demolished everything in its path. And another was the tremendous volume of heat that was generated by that the fire that was burning below the Trade Center. So those two things together really, to a great extent, eliminated us seeing much of anything that we would recognize. I might note, as far as the fire itself, just to give you an idea of how intense it was, of course, we know the day was September 11th when the attack occurred. And I recall late in November, about 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, we came off the pile to get a cup of coffee. And my lieutenant and I were standing at the perimeter and just watching some of these large, heavy equipment grapplers they were using. And they could actually grab onto a piece of steel and just work it and shake it and pull. And eventually they would be able to free the steel from the pile. And we watched this one grappler work for quite a bit of time. And those guys were really expert at how they handled those machines. And eventually, he pulled a large box beam, a very, very long box beam, out of the pile. And the far end of that box beam was dripping steel. And this was late November. That's how hot the fire still was burning at that point. It was, we were shocked.
Senator Graham, you know, as we hear this, you know, compelling firsthand account, I wonder if you worry about perhaps a sense of disconnect between folks who experienced 9/11 and younger generations. You know, kids who are in college today might not really have much of a memory based on their age or perhaps not even being born yet of that day.
That's why I think it's important that the kinds of stories, and I've been fascinated listening to your two previous guests, be maintained and shared with future generations. It's just, it's similar. I was a child during World War II, and most of what I know in terms of the personal aspects of it came through my two brothers who were both in service during World War II. A nation that forgets its history is a nation which is condemned to repeating it. So it's important that what we just heard be heard by people who were not old enough to remember 9/11 and those who will be born much later than 9/11.
And Senator Graham, in reference to the, you know, 28 classified pages we referred to earlier in the show, you've been a longtime vocal advocate for declassification of that information. Tell us a bit about kind of what was behind your motivation for wanting to get this information out to the public.
After 9/11, the leadership of the Congress determined that it was important that there be a congressional inquiry into what had transpired, and the decision was made to merge the House and Senate Intelligence Committee to conduct that inquiry. Coincidentally, it happened that the chairs of those committees were both Floridians, Porter Goss, a congressman from Sanibel, and myself from Miami Lakes. We conducted an investigation that lasted over a year. We collected tens of thousands of documents, interviewed hundreds of people, and wrote an 800-page final report of our findings and recommendations. When that report was submitted in December of 2002, it was then sent to a declassification unit within the federal government. It took 6 months to review all of our materials and make a recommendation as to what materials could be released to the public and what would be declared classified. Part of the classified section was a chapter of 28 pages, which primarily related to who had funded 9/11. I was very disturbed at the time that that information was being withheld from the American people. Almost a majority of the U.S. Senate signed a resolution urging that the 28 pages be released. Unfortunately, they stayed in under suppressed conditions until July the 15th of this year. I think there have been a number of adverse things have occurred to the country in part because of that withholding, one of those being the Iraq War. The president announced that if any other entity, individual, or nation was found to have been of assistance to the hijackers, that we would follow them to the ends of the earth to get justice, because the information about the Saudi involvement was largely withheld. The attention was not focused on the country that, in my judgment, actually had been a co-conspirator with the 19 hijackers, but rather on Iraq. I think the worst foreign policy national security decision, at least in modern American history, occurred when we went to war with Iraq and all of the complexities that that led to, and we didn't hold accountable the country that actually had assisted the 19 hijackers.
Senator Graham, what does this mean now, 15 years later, with this information coming out, just in terms of continued diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia?
I think it means a number of things. Many people have said that this 15 years have passed, let's move on. In fact, a leading official in the FBI told me in 2011 to stop this effort to get the 28 pages released and get a life. That was old business. Well, I think it's not old business for a number of reasons. One, justice. Those 3,000 families who were so egregiously affected, and people like the first responders, they deserve justice. And thus far, they have been denied the opportunity to take to an American court the facts of the Saudi involvement. And if they are able to sustain those facts in a court of law, to receive justice. The second reason why I think this is important is national security. The Saudis have interpreted our failure to act, our failure to bring them to account, as being immunity. And therefore, the Saudis have continued, as they have been for many years, to be the primary funder of terrorist organizations, and through their Wahhabist mosque and madrasas, schools, the primary trainer of a new generation of terrorists, so that the two things that any terrorist organization must have, money and fresh recruits, have been largely supplied through the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And finally, I think it's had a very detrimental effect on the American people. We have a level of cynicism and distrust between the people and their government, unknown in our history today, and the presidential campaign is illustrating that. So I think it's very important that the 28 pages and what we will learn as a result of the 28 pages being released. I describe the 28 pages as being the cork in the bottle. There's a lot of liquids still there that will give us even more information as to who facilitated this most horrific attack against the United States in modern history.
And, of course, there was another a prominent Southwest Florida connection with hijackers actually trained in the Sarasota area, and their connections with a prominent Saudi Arabian family who left the U.S. just 10 days before the attack.
Yes, that's in the category of things that were not known at the time the 28 pages were being written, which was the fall of 2002. It also is an example that most of what is in the 28 pages is a result of what we learned almost contemporaneously with the attack itself about San Diego and Los Angeles. There were only three of the 19 hijackers involved in that Southern California cabal. Most of the hijackers lived east of the Mississippi, and most of those live in Florida, with large numbers also living in places like New Jersey and Virginia. So we know a lot more today than we did immediately after the attack, and Sarasota is a good example of where we have learned about a prominent Saudi family having many connections with three of the hijackers, including Mohammed Atta, who were doing their flight training in Venice. And yet all of that information has been held tightly by the FBI until finally a federal judge demanded that it be made available to him. And he's had it now for 2 years, deciding which of the 80,000 pages of documentation that the FBI made available to him deserve to be continued in the classified status and which should be released to the American people.
All right. And Mohammed al-Darsani, imam with the Islamic Center for Peace here in Fort Myers, you know, as we all know, with al-Qaeda taking responsibility for that attack that, you know, elicited a lot of fear-based responses against people like yourself and practitioners of Islam. Can you tell us about your remembrances of that day and perhaps how that changed your day-to-day life?
Sure, and actually changed my life and the life of many Muslims all over the world. Unfortunately, the alleged actions of a few reflected on a whole nation, and I don't mean geographically nation-wise. All over the world, Muslims are paying the price until today, unfortunately, for that crime committed by a few. On the personal level, really, I remember vividly that day. I was not watching television at the time when the planes hit the towers, but I received a phone call at that time from my wife. I was at work, and she said, do you have a television to see what's going on? And when I turned the TV on, I was shocked because they were replaying the video clips of the planes hitting the towers. So I immediately felt, oh, my God, this is going to be big. A couple of hours later, when the news started coming up and they confirmed it was a terrorist attack, and as usual, automatically the mentality, unfortunately, in the country and in the media especially, goes toward, okay, anytime there is a terrorist attack, that means Muslims are doing it. So I immediately felt we're going to have big, big trouble on our hands today. That afternoon, immediately, I went to the mosque. At that time, I was the acting imam of the mosque at the Islamic Center of Southwest Florida, and I was anticipating maybe some people will react in a vicious way and they'll come probably for a revenge or at least to show an outrage. So I thought it is my responsibility to be there. Fortunately, the opposite happened. We started receiving, to the contrary of what we thought, positive messages and people calling to say, look, we don't believe all Muslims are bad. We don't believe you would be involved in something like this. And from that evening on, and this is true, we started building relationship and have more connections with the community around us than ever before, and that has been going on until today. Recently, we formed a group called the Interfaith Action Group, and we all from different faiths, Christians, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, and others, coming together to put our faith to practice and see how we can bring peace to the community, to the society, and how we can combat violence on faith-based way. So we ask everybody also to join with us. On that night, September 11, I started a friendship with a reverend here in the area named Dwayne Robinson, who picked up the phone and said, is there anything I can do? And he came to the mosque, and suddenly several people, Christians and others, and there were so many Hindus workers working for GE, I believe, at that time, some were here. They were so distressed. And suddenly the mosque attracted so many people who were not Muslims but sympathized with the Muslims. Later on during the week and after that, people started sending flowers, leaving good messages. We had one single bad message on our answering machine back then, and everything else was positive to the degree ladies from the community offered to come and escort our ladies if they go to malls or to go shopping so they will not be harassed. We had people on Fridays to come and offer protections to the mosque. The sheriff's office at that time, on their initiative, without any request from us, they sent security people to make sure the area is secured and the mosque is secured from any potential, you know, reaction. And like I said, it changed the world, changed the Muslim community itself in the United States. It changed how Muslims around the world are viewing now certain groups of Muslims. And there is a dialogue now, and there is a debate going on within the Muslim world and between Muslims and non-Muslims. I know it was a horrendous crime. It was a crime against humanity. It was not against Americans only. And against every religion, not only American Christians who died there. There were Jews, there were Muslims, there were atheists, there were people from all backgrounds died on 9/11. So it affected almost everybody in the world. And what we can do forward now is take that tragedy and take that negative things and try to build some positive and some good things based on it, how we can deal with the differences. 9/11 did not come out of a vacuum. We need to start asking the question, why? And we need to know all the stories. And as Governor Graham said earlier, if you don't learn from the history, you are deemed to repeat it. And what happened in 9/11 might be repeated again if we keep doing the same thing we have been doing. So we need to ask the tough questions. We have to have those difficult conversations. And we have to know the facts also, as Governor Graham already said. The facts should be out there, because the truth will set everybody free and will set everything straight.
I think that's a great note to leave this conversation on, as we're out of time for this portion of the program. But thanks so much to my guests. We've been speaking with former Florida Governor and U.S. Senator Bob Graham, Muhammad al-Darsani, the imam and founder of the Islamic Center for Peace, Garrett Lindgren, retired New York City firefighter and current Manatee County resident, and former WGCU reporter Valerie Alker, who was with President Bush the morning of the 9/11 attacks. We're taking a short break, but when we return, sea turtle nesting activity this year in Florida pointed toward a possibly record-breaking year earlier this summer. We'll explore the latest numbers and how recent high tides, stormy weather, and Hurricane Hermine is impacting the viability of threatened and endangered sea turtle nests. That's just ahead. Stay with us. You're listening to WGCU NPR for Southwest Florida.